Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We're going to check in with Adam Boileau in a minute to recap the week's security news, and there has been a lot of stuff happening. Number one, of course, is the North Korea indictment. BA's website, British Air, their website got owned pretty hard, but as you'll hear, they're not the only ones having a bad time at the moment with those sorts of shenanigans. We've got flaws in WebAuthn to talk about, a bunch of Washington DC action, and a whole lot more. And we've got a great sponsor interview for you this week. We'll be joined by Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary. And Thinkst did something unusual over the last couple of weeks. They actually removed a feature in their Canary product. We'll be talking about that and also the tendency of security software to be too complicated and configurable. Just too much. That's a great chat, and it's coming up after this, the news with Adam Boileau. And of course, Adam, the big news is last week the United States dropped an indictment against a North Korean computer criminal who also happens to work for the North Korean government.
Yes, they've announced charges against one Park Jin-hyuk, North Korean computer programmer. He works for a company called Chosun Expo, or the Korean Expo Joint Venture, as well as you say, working for the Korean Reconnaissance General Bureau doing computer hacking on behalf of the North Korean government. Specifically, they're attributing stuff like Sony, the hack of Sony Pictures, which involved RMing all of their boxes, things like WannaCry, all that kind of thing.
And the Bangladesh stuff as well.
Bangladesh Swift hacks, not to, just to pick a few things.
Yeah, and we're talking about, this is a 179-page indictment that reads like the world's most boring Brian Krebs article, basically.
Yeah, exactly right. Oh, dear. It's interesting because we haven't really seen this kind of tool used against North Korea before. We've seen them, put charges against Russians, against Chinese, but yeah, this was a new attack against North Korea.
Well, and I guess there's... hold your horses there, because I've heard a lot of people sort of interpreting this as some form of statecraft, but honestly, it just reads like a criminal indictment. The fact that the guy works for the North Korean government, to me, is neither here nor there, because he's being charged with crime stuff, not really espionage stuff, it just feels a little different to me. I mean, this, even if you remove North Korea from this completely, it looks like a completely normal indictment.
Yeah, you're right, I guess. Some of the targets here, the Sony Pictures, the banks, right? Those are kind of straight up, the bank at the very least, it's straight up criminal, right? The attack against Sony is kind of censorship, I guess, sort of spite, I don't know, trying to stop and put out a movie that was nasty about Kim Jong-un.
But we've seen hacktivists do similar stuff to whatever company they could access. Like, we're going to RM your boxes and release all your crap. Like, it's not, this ain't APT1 is what I'm getting at.
No.
Or Fancy Bear.
There are some, I guess somewhat relevant targets. Lockheed Martin was one of the ones that he's accused of hitting, which, maybe that's fair game for a state, for state activity. But yeah, you're right. A lot of this is pretty straight up criminal stuff. And the fact that it's being used to fund, North Korean military or whatever other, bits of their economy need foreign currency, maybe is, as you said, not really the point.
Well, one thing that surprised me about the indictment, and it shouldn't have really, is the ease with which the FBI were able to connect all of this activity to common infrastructure by doing something as simple as dropping warrants on, Google to give them Gmail inboxes and then just piecing it all together. Their OPSEC is pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's certainly not the world's most advanced OPSEC. And as you say, Brian Krebs, it's very much in solid Krebsing territory here. There's nothing super, that requires, hacking the cameras in the, the buildings and things like they have to do it against the Russians. So yeah, the OPSEC is a little bit slack. They're asserting that there's a couple of hundred people working in this particular bit of the North Korean government. They've obviously picked on one guy, there's some suggestion that the aliases that this guy uses are being used by a bunch of people. I think, they're obviously going to learn lessons about their OPSEC, because they have been learning lessons about their OPSEC, once North Korean attacks really got prominence after the Sony thing and WannaCry and getting caught doing the Swifts. So I'm sure they've been taking a lot of OPSEC lessons, I can't imagine that they won't learn a bunch of lessons from this.
Yeah, well done to you, Nathan P. Shields, Special Agent FBI, for having the patience to actually write the bloody thing. I could, I was forced to skim it because it's, you know, it's pretty slow going, just laboriously tying it all together. One interesting effect of the release of this indictment has been the sheer level of "I told you so" going around on Twitter. Because, of course, at the time, there were a lot of people who denied that the North Koreans were responsible for this, and there were people presenting alternative theories. I think, if I recall correctly, at the time we said, look, you know, we can't definitively say that it's North Korea, but we did look at the alternative theories and none of them made any sense whatsoever. Like this idea that it was insiders who were disgruntled employees who could also simultaneously emulate perfectly North Korean, you know, North Korean APT activity to the extent that it would fool people in the DFIR community was always just really weird. But there's been a lot of "I told you so" going around.
Yeah, I remember when we talked about it way back at, you know, when Sony first got popped, you know, kind of arriving at the conclusion that, you know, this is crazy that it's North Koreans, but it is the least crazy of the proposed options. And, you know, maybe it is actually believable. And yeah, turns out totally was. I mean, I think we were a little startled at the time because it was a bit unprecedented in a way to see a nation state whacking on a corporate entity just for, you know, essentially shits and giggles.
I just remember one thing you said at the time, which was, you know, you remember the image they put on the Sony computers after they'd, you know, after they'd wiped them, and it was like the, you know, the skeletons and stuff like that. And it was, so, you know, I think you said at the time, this is exactly the sort of graphic design you get when a North Korean colonel, you know, tells them to make it look like hackers. You know, and it turns out too, they used the similar artwork as one point of attribution to the, you know, common attribution with the Dark Soul attacks. But yeah, look, you know, the TLDR is North Korea has been called out on this one, and in particular one guy who, of course, will never be indicted. And look, speaking of that, we've seen the most ridiculous take on this, you know, in my opinion, doing the rounds, which was Jake Williams, of course, who's ex-NSA guy, writing up for the Daily Beast that we shouldn't name this guy in the indictment because they'll put a bullet in his head and all of this sort of stuff. And I just think this is a really strange way of thinking, that we shouldn't indict people for the crimes that they've committed because bad things might happen to them. His point seems to be that the guy didn't have a choice in committing these acts. But, you know, there's a fairly thorough rebuttal that I've linked to in this week's show notes written by a friend of the show, Bobby Chesney.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously you can see I got some sympathy for Jake Williams' write-up because you can kind of see that he is doing it from the heart, right? And especially having worked on, you know, on the NSA side of the fence, you know, I guess, you know, there's a bunch of opinions about, you know, what happens if it happens to us.
But he's been banging this drum for a long time. And, you know, the only people we're seeing being indicted are people who really are stepping outside the norms. You know, which this clearly meets that bar. And this idea that something bad might happen to the guy, why would it? It's not like North Korea is going to extradite the guy. Do you know what I mean? They're not going to kill him so they don't have to extradite him. They don't have an extradition treaty with the US. It's just really bizarre.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Bobby Chesney's rebuttal does make a lot of quite good points about, you know, the difference between, you know, the sort of immunity that you get when you're a combatant in wartime versus, you know, what fundamentally is criminal, as you pointed out at the top of the show, fundamentally in many cases, you know, criminal theft rather than, you know, espionage or, you know, actual kind of war fighting. And that, you know, in those cases, we would prosecute people who were committing crimes, you know, even if they are following orders, because these are not, you know, this is not a wartime. This is not a war situation where, you know, those exemptions kind of exist to prevent that happening. And I think, you know, he does make a pretty cogent point. I mean,
it's petty crime on a grand scale, basically. It's not, this is not the projection of, I don't know. It's just, I think people have gotten a little bit carried away on this indictment. I don't think it's as consequential as others do.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, also in one of Bobby's other points is we haven't seen a rebuttal, right? We haven't seen someone come up and say, oh, well, we're going to go and charge, you know, the you know, NSA hackers for, you know, breaking into Vodafone Athens or whatever, right? We haven't seen that kind of thing happen. And until we do, it's kind of a bit academic to say, well, doesn't this set a precedent, right? I mean, until it actually does,
Yeah.
You know, it's not really, you know, it is kind of hypothetical.
Now, look, the other big news of the week is, of course, a breach involving British Airways. This was apparently pulled off by the same people who attacked Ticketmaster. You know, it was a JavaScript include which captured credit card details. Pretty big deal, this one. And, you know, as we're going to discover in a moment, this type of activity, whether or not it's the same crew involved in the activity we're going to talk about next, there's a lot of this going on at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar MO to the Ticketmaster one. In this case, you know, like JavaScript shoved into the depths of some JavaScript file that, you know, catches key up events, reads the contents of the forms on the page, finds the credit card data, exfills it over the network, in this case, like a box in Lithuania or something, including, in this case, CVV details, which is a little bit awkward.
Ruh-roh.
Yeah, so credit card details with CVV values because you're scraping it right at point of entry. They're talking something like, 380,000 users worth of data was nicked in the time window that BA was talking about, which is from, you know, late August through early September this year. Obviously, they do a lot of transactions, but that's a lot of people's cards.
Especially when you've got full CVV and you know they're good active cards, right? Like, this isn't dump, right?
Well, exactly right. And also, I mean, if you're buying a plane ticket, right, a reasonable amount of those purchases are high value. You know, it's going to be a good source of card data. Pretty attractive target for this particular crew. And, yeah, I mean, BA has kind of flubbed the response a little bit, saying, we didn't store CVV values, trying to somehow sort of imply that, that therefore they didn't get stolen because they didn't get stored. Therefore, maybe PCI, maybe we don't get smacked by the card brands quite so much. But in the end, I don't think people who've had their card stolen really care about that degree of weaseling. Just not ideal. And the travel industry in general, of course, has always been a place that card fraud has been pretty rampant.
Well, it's funny, right? Because I had this other story sent to me by a listener from the website bankinfosecurity.com. It was written by Jeremy Kirk, and it's looking at this massive card skimming malware campaign affecting websites. I mean, we're talking like 7,000 Magento websites that have been taken over, very similar MO. So it looks like there's some pretty, you know, this MO is popular at the moment. I don't know if this is the same people, but this is becoming the new way to grab your card data, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, it's kind of a natural evolution, right? Once PCI came in, made it more difficult for people to store this data badly in databases.
Come on, man, PCI's been around a while.
Well, hey, this thing's moved slowly, right?
Glacially.
But yeah, I mean, if you move the data to the, you know, to point of entry rather than it being stored in big databases that you can nick with one SQL injection, then, of course, attackers are going to go and steal it in the client one at a time with some JavaScript rather than stealing it out of the back end with SQL, right? It's kind of the natural evolution of the process. I think Magento is a funny one because didn't they get bought by Adobe or something?
Magento has, yeah, been acquired by Adobe. So that's going to be an Adobe product. So this will be interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And, you know, the thing is, I sort of feel like, you know, if a company like Adobe does acquire, you know, Magento is like the WordPress of online stores, right? So, you know, I sort of have a feeling that having the stewardship of a company that can kind of make big decisions might result in a better ecosystem than the mess we've got with WordPress at the moment.
Yeah, well, you'd certainly hope so. But, I mean, I think this might be a good thing to, you know, make sure Adobe focuses its attention on the ecosystem around Magento because, I mean, clearly it has the potential to go kind of bad for them if it continues to be, you know, a really big target, continues to get lots of stuff stolen still, they could suffer for that. So, yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of Adobe people who listen. So, you know, hi, I'm sure you're totally on top of it.
Now, there's been a bit of chatter going around about some possible flaws in the WebAuthn protocol. Of course, this is a very, very new protocol, showing a great deal of promise and something that I think everyone agrees is a good thing. But apparently, you know, now that it's out there in the public domain, people have sort of had a bit of a look at it and picked on a few parts of it. And it looks like the criticism is warranted.
Yes, I mean this is the kind of the evolution of the FIDO consortium standard for doing WebAuth with hardware tokens. There is a kind of version 2 of that kicking around now, and yeah, some people have been digging into some of the options for implementers in terms of exactly what mechanisms for like key derivation that they use. Some researchers do have fairly legitimate criticisms about some of the options for key derivation. It seems like the FIDO Alliance and the researchers in question have been kind of, you know, talking through, and you know, part of the discussion here is that the documentation seems to suggest that a couple of particularly old mechanisms for doing key derivation are kind of mentioned in the standard as being required, when maybe they're with a suggestion that that might be sort of the only ones that people would implement, as opposed to some of the better ones. Anyway, there's a bunch of argument about it. Net result, I think, is, you know, whilst this is a standard that we're building that's going to solve very real problems and going to be around for a while and isn't therefore important to get right, that, you know, these are not world-ending kind of terrible attacks. Like, it's kind of, you know, good crypto research, real attacks, but not ones that I think necessarily are going to, you know, scupper it or anything like that. It's just, you know, the process of, you know, of wider...
It's not like anyone's saying that WebAuthn is a dead duck. They're just saying, well, there's a few things here that where there's room for improvement, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it does seem like the suggestions are going to be, you know, implement some of the other options that are better rather than the extra rubbish ones that are still there for backwards compatibility reasons, or, you know, I'm not sure of exactly why they're still using some of these ancient cryptographic mechanisms in what ought to be a relatively modern standard. But hey, I don't know. I ain't a crypto guy either.
Now, Microsoft has published something interesting here. Of course, we saw the Cloud Act created and passed in the United States, and this is, you know, the central piece of legislation that's going to enable a lot of this MLAT, you know, mutual legal assistance reform, enabling, you know, authorities in countries like Australia to be able to obtain, to acquire evidence from, you know, US tech firms without having to go through the very, very complicated and lengthy MLAT process. Microsoft has basically written, yeah, I guess they're just making their position clear on how they feel these requests should be treated sort of universally, globally. They've written down six guiding principles, and they actually look really quite reasonable, Adam.
Yeah, it seems like sort of a nice set of principles that, you know, are meant to be able to be applicable across a bunch of jurisdictions and, you know, sort of represent a basic set of expectations that Microsoft and its user base should have for how, you know, cloud corporations will interact with government and requests by governments to access data. A bunch of these are not things that are going to surprise anyone. You know, things like they propose a universal right to notice that they'll be able to tell users, except in very extreme cases, that their data has been accessed, that there's a process for warrants, there's a process for challenging. One of the ones that I thought was interesting is that there was a specific one which they phrase as modernizing, which is one of the more weaselly words in the entire thing, modernizing rules for seeking enterprise data. That the suggestion that law enforcement, you know, when you've got an enterprise hosting data in the cloud, that they should not be going to the cloud provider as the first port of call. They should be going to, you know, the company that is hosting data in the cloud.
Someone's trying to save a few bucks in their warrant processing department.
Yeah, exactly. But it does, you know, that's an interesting one, I thought, just because it, you know, kind of calls out a slightly different set of standards for enterprise data versus personal data, which, you know, interesting new ones.
Yeah, all in all, I think it's a very sensible document, and you know, it's a very clearly written thing, and we've linked to it in this week's show notes, so people can check that out if they would like. Christopher Bing, who used to work at CyberScoop but is now over at Reuters, well, that's paying dividends for them because he got a great story here about Trump apparently being on the cusp of signing an executive order targeting anyone who would seek to interfere with you know, the upcoming US elections.
Yeah, the Trump administration has been kind of somewhat having its hand forced, I think, by the kind of desire by both sides of the, you know, political establishment in the US to really, you know, actually do something about the level of interference and, you know, influence campaigns in the last elections there. And I think this is proposing that they would be able to apply sanctions to organizations that are found to be meddling, you know, in influence operations or meddling in actual election technology. It does rather delegate, you know, the responsibility to figure out who's doing what to various bits of the US intelligence apparatus. Obviously, there'll still be some oversight in terms of who actually does get sanctioned in the end. But it does, you know, kind of sends a message that, you know, there will be some consequence to this, which I think is really what people in, you know, on both sides have been kind of chomping at the bit for.
Yeah, I mean, they're sending a signal here that they're going to get very sanctions happy against individuals who are involved in this stuff. So if you're even within 10 paces of it, you know, you're going to get your bank accounts frozen. So it might make some people think twice, or maybe certain people with a lot to lose who might have the ear of, influential people in certain countries, maybe to discourage them from doing things that they might have otherwise been thinking about doing. So it just seems like a fairly sensible thing. We won't know how much of an effect it has, of course, until after the midterms in November. Meanwhile, the US House of Representatives has actually passed a bipartisan bill designed to deter foreign governments from conducting so-called hacking operations against US critical infrastructure. They've called it the Cyber Deterrence and Response Act. Is this more of the same? Sanctions happy? Or what's this about?
Yeah, and the intent of this is also to you know, use sanctions as a tool to target organizations and countries that, you know, that are attacking specific critical infrastructure. You know, it's kind of part of this larger, you know, naming and shaming narrative that the US is trying to use at the moment. Because, I mean, in the case of, you know, in countries like North Korea, there's not much left to sanction, but you can go after corporations and people that have relationships.
But it's so weird. Here we are, where the US government is passing laws saying if you hack our power grid, we'll dox you. I mean, that's basically what this is.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't think that would necessarily need one, but, you know, hey, we live in strange and interesting times. And
yes, we do.
Yeah, they're, you know, I guess doxing is one of the things that we've got that does fall short of, you know, full-scale armed conflict or, you know, kinetic options.
Geopolitics is now about flame wars, like IRC flame wars, pretty much. So there you go. There's an IoT security bill that is apparently very soon to become law in California, subject to approval of the governor there. And it could be, you know, in effect as early as 2020, which is cool, right? But really the law says two things. It says, first of all, if you're going to include a default password in a device that you're manufacturing, it has to be a unique password for every device that you ship, or the user is required to enter a unique password when they turn the thing on for the first time. Okay, that's cool. And then otherwise it says that the thing has to have, needs to be sort of reasonably secured. And they've left that very open, and this is the thing, right? A lot of people are being very critical of that, saying, well, you haven't defined what's reasonable. But believe me when I say, when it comes time to litigate, courts are pretty good at figuring out what's reasonable and what isn't.
Yeah, I think that the criticism of this bill perhaps is a little bit unfair. I mean, it's been picked on because it has those two disparate ends of, you know, a very general, you should be reasonable, have reasonable security, and then a couple of oddly specific, you shouldn't have default passwords, and, you know, you should force the user
to set a
password.
But see, to me, that feels about right. It's like, let's eliminate this very basic thing by being prescriptive, you know, which is the default password thing, which is causing a lot of trouble, and then just tack on the reasonableness test for the rest of it. You know, seems perfect to me.
Well, I mean, it's very hard to argue with the fact that there are botnets out doing the rounds, brute forcing default creds, right? I mean, you know, it is
brute forcing is a strong word.
Abin, Cisco, right? These are, you know, there's a short list.
Is it brute forcing or is it polite forcing? I think is the term you'd use for this, you know.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the kind of fallout from this is, like whether we do see. I mean, you know, IoT security is hard because it is so, like, there's so little money in IoT devices, and expecting people to do things right on a mass market scale, you know, for very little margin, you know.
I used to agree with that, but there are frameworks out there now. I mean, Amazon publishes one, for God's sake, that actually makes this pretty easy. So you'd think, you know, use a modern framework and you're basically okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope that this does push, you know, some of the more garbage consumer electronic vendors, you know, towards having to do a better job. You know, California is a pretty big market and, you know, an influential market. So maybe it will lead to some improvement everywhere else. And, you know, this really is the first kind of, you know, IoT specific sort of thing we've seen anywhere. So, you know, hopefully it will lead the way despite the criticisms that it's got.
Now, this next story has me scratching my head. It's another one from CyberScoop. Apparently, the House has passed two bills that aim to bolster the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity efforts as they relate to securing the agency's own vendor supply chain as well as securing other federal agencies' networks. It seems like one of these bills that they've passed here allows the DHS to make decisions supply chain decisions for its own contracts. And I'm thinking, you need a law to do that? Like, what?
It's exactly. What? I read the article and I had the same thing. Like, what's the. Yeah, why? Like, surely making decisions about your own supply chain was a thing that they could already do? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. Alex Stamos has popped up again. He is now, you know, the former Facebook CISO and is, as far as I can tell, very happily working away at Stanford University, where he's, you know, he's entered his new life as an academic. I've been looking for some leather patches for his jackets, for elbow patches that we can send him. But he stopped by Disrupt and TechCrunch Disrupt and had some pretty interesting stuff to say.
Yeah, and I had a sort of quite a few good conversations about some aspects of his life at Facebook and, of course, Yahoo before that. There was a bunch of great sound bites that came out of this. He said, it's kind of a crappy job to be a chief security officer. It's kind of like being a chief financial officer before accounting was invented.
Gold.
And yeah, like, I've never been a CISO, but that sounds so 100% relatable. And yes, I pity all of the poor CISOs who are listening to the show. And yes, Alex is totally with you.
Yeah, and he had some really interesting stuff to say about, you know, what he feels the GRU's objectives were in, you know, in the 2016 campaign and all of that. So, you know, we won't go into it too much here, but there's a couple of links in this week's show notes so people can check that out if they're interested in. Meanwhile, Facebook and Twitter executives have appeared before a congressional hearing and admitted we haven't done enough to combat influence ops, which is like, well, yeah, okay. You've said that now, but can we actually see some action is my first thought, you know?
I think the, you know, we haven't done enough kind of line is the sort of free credit monitoring of this kind of, you know, it's the equivalent of promising free credit monitoring for this kind of congressional, you know, inquiry or something. Because we, you know, we see it used as a, you know, kind of, yes, we haven't done enough. Yes, we admit it. Yes, yes, yes. Although to be fair, Google didn't show up and say yes. So I guess that's something to talk about. But yeah, basically, I mean, both of them are saying, yes, we didn't do enough, but don't worry, we've totally got some machine learning on it now. And, you know, we're going to clean up the Twitters and clean up the Facebooks and, you know, and we'll totally get on this.
Trend Micro having a bad week.
Trend. Oh, dear. Trend Micro have a bunch of dubiously named, mobile and other, you know, and desktop antivirus apps with names like Dr. Cleaner and Dr. Antivirus and Dr. Unarchiver. Anyway, a bunch of those apparently were reusing a component that would rummage around and steal the browsing history from your browsers and a bunch of other things. Trend Micro are saying that, you know, it was a piece of code that they used in one product and they accidentally reused it a bunch of other places without meaning to and terribly sorry. The apps in question have disappeared from the Apple Mac App Store, I think. But yeah, not really a great look for a company that's meant to be improving computer security.
No, definitely not. Trend Micro, AV company and proud sponsor of Risky Business. But there you go, guys. Like, what are you doing? Hi there, guys. Oops. Now, moving on, Tesla. This is interesting, right? Because I think this was kind of announced maybe like longer than a week ago. But they basically said that if you brick your car when you're doing security research on it, that's fine. You haven't voided your warranty. So that's kind of interesting, right? But there's sort of another round of reporting circulating on this now.
Yeah, no, it is nice to see. I mean, people who, you know, are into, you know, car hacking obviously have, you know, much more of a barrier to entry than people who are into hacking, you know, IoT devices or, you know, whatever other much cheaper, much more available things that you can hack on. If you brick your car, then, you know, obviously that's going to be a real problem for you. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to see Tesla coming out and saying, if you operate, you know, within the bounds of our bug bounty program, you know, doing, good faith security research, that you're not going to void your warranty and we'll provide you support if you do need to reflash your car and we value the work that you're doing. And, you know, to some extent, like even just saying that we value the research community, security research community's work in improving our products, like that's a long way from, you know, what we used to see 5, 10, you know, years ago, even, you know, to this day with some vendors, you know, Oracle come to mind as a, you know, a company that's particularly hostile to, you know, free QA testing.
Don't
is what we're doing.
Yeah, we don't even need to get started about that. I mean, there was that infamous post. I mean, for people who are perhaps, you know, newer listeners to Risky Business, I mean, Oracle's chief security officer actually wrote a blog post, you know, basically saying they were going to go after researchers for violating Oracle's IP rights if they reverse engineered stuff. Like, they've just got the most insane out of step attitude. In my view, you know, Oracle really just is the poster child for how to absolutely do it wrong. And, you know, it doesn't really surprise me that that Tesla's doing this. I mean, Elon Musk, you know, put down the whiskey and the blunt for long enough to head over to DEF CON, actually, you know, this year. And he had a short chat with Casey Ellis and also had a bit of a chat with Mark Dowd, which was interesting. So, yeah, he sort of popped in to have a bit of a chin wag with people, and he seems to genuinely, you know, admire the community, which is good.
Yeah, actually, I ran into Dowd just after he'd been talking to Elon, and apparently Elon asked Dowd, oh, so what have you hacked? And it's like, well,
everything.
Mark Dowd says, you know, it's got sendmail technique, amongst other things. But yeah, so no, it's kind of good to see them taking it seriously, obviously, because, you know, security of those cars is important for them. And yeah, nice to see him, you know, doing something that isn't a terrible headline this week.
Also, with Tesla, there were a couple of researchers at a Belgian university who actually found a way to, you know, like steal Model S's by bypassing their, you know, the actual vehicle security controls.
Yeah, this is some really cool research. They extended the kind of, you know, we've seen a bunch of cars hacked in the past where, you know, there's a relay attack where you replay the challenge from the car to the wireless key fob in the owner's pocket. You replay it back to the car, you know, across a pair of radios, one near the car, one near the attacker, and you use that to kind of break into the car. In this case, the researchers actually went as far as implementing a rainbow table to recover the private key from the you know, that's shared between the fob and the car, you know, having replayed a challenge from the car to the fob, got two responses from the fob, look it up in a you know, 6 gig rainbow table or whatever, and at that point you've essentially cloned the key and you can, you know, restart the car, drive off.
What sort of key space are they using for that? Like, if you can use a 6 gig rainbow table against it.
Well, actually, sorry, 6 terabyte, my mistake, 6 terabyte rainbow table.
Holy
by,
God.
You know, a little bit there. The key systems are actually from a third-party vendor called Pectron. And yeah, it's really not modern crypto. It's a 40-bit key space, which is, of course, why we've ended up with this kind of rubbish going on. Tesla, for their part, are apparently shipping an updated key system in new Teslas, and they've rolled out a software update that lets you, like, enter a PIN on the dashboard of your car. So yeah, that's not ideal. I mean, I think the obvious answer here is that, you know, a system where you do actually have to press the button on the fob to have it send the response perhaps is a sensible kind of middle ground, you know, for this kind of issue.
That'd get annoying. I mean, I've got a car for the first time in my life that I just walk up to with the key in my pocket and open the door, and it becomes something that you become very accustomed to. But look, whether it's 6 gig or 6 terabytes, you shouldn't be able to use a rainbow attack against a you know, a modern crypto system.
Clearly 40 bits is not a modern crypto system.
No.
So, yeah.
I will tell you one funny thing that happened, though, is that car had an unfortunate encounter with a telephone pole and wound up in the shop for a little bit. So I was driving my my crappy old four-wheel drive around, and I have wound up walking to that car and just yanking on the handle without pulling the key out. And that's what I mean. It's one of those features that you just get very, very used to. Yeah, and I think for their troubles, these researchers got paid 10 grand, which to me seems a little stingy for a bug this good. But I believe, Adam, also that this keying system is used by other manufacturers.
Yeah, the reports are that the same system is in use by McLaren, which might be a slightly more expensive car to steal, and also some models of Triumph motorbikes use the same rubbish system from Pectron.
There you go. Now, we've seen a bit of action on the JP Morgan Chase hack. The United States has managed to extradite a Russian who was being held in Georgia to the US.
Yeah, this is one Andrei Turin, who was involved in the data breach at JP Morgan Chase back in 2014. They nicked, I think, 80 million customers worth of usernames and email addresses and stuff back then, which, you know, is not, as data breaches go, not a huge amount of sensitive data. But then they actually used that for a pump and dump scheme and, you know, made a fairly reasonable amount of money in that. So, yeah, you know, continuing, I guess, the, you know, the theme of these indictments, you know, against people who are in Russia, you know, and then waiting until many years later they show up in the place that does have an extradition arrangement. And yeah, it sucks to be them.
Yeah. So if you've ever been involved in this sort of crime and you're thinking about taking that holiday and you're thinking it'll be fine, it probably won't be, just so you know. Oh, now this is interesting. NIST and DHS are apparently looking at introducing some sort of standard designed to protect against BGP hijacks. And the immediate question is, how on earth would you do that?
Yeah, well, this is part of, I guess, you know, an ongoing project to try and deal with, you know, BGP hijacking and bad route advertisements that's been going on, you know, since the Loft days. Of course, they're going to solve this with the usual tools that we solve everything, a PKI infrastructure.
Yeah, it's going to be like DNSSEC for BGP tables, right? Like, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
They certainly haven't learned any lessons. They called it BGPSEC, or at least one of the parts is called BGPSEC, which, you know, is kind of a, you know, like calling it the Titanic or something, you know, by comparison to DNSSEC. But yeah, I mean, they've been working on standards for all the various parts of this, like the bit where, you know, NetBlock owners have private key material and can sign their advertisements and say which intermediate providers they expect to be able to advertise their networks, then a PKI infrastructure to allow routers and intermediate networks to validate those announcements, and plus all the necessary kind of changes to BGP to allow to propagate those, you know, kind of signatures.
But it just seems a weird thing to be focusing on when, as an industry, you know, we're really, really moving towards making BGP hijacks kind of redundant by deploying, you know, encryption on our applications.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still plenty of places where, you know, it's still a useful thing to have. And not least the denial of service aspects. I mean, if we take out, even if everything was end-to-end encrypted, you could still cause all sorts of things to break, which you know, is still a good reason to address.
Well, and there's, you know, the also, you know, content problem. Injection into, you know, into HTTP sessions and things like that if you've got, you know, some nice browser exploits you want to try out on a few people.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you know, there's loads of stuff that you can do by getting into the middle of the network. And, you know, it's a problem that the engineering community, you know, the network engineering community has been trying to deal with for a very long time. And unfortunately, that's the real criticism here, is not that these are not good technical solutions to the problem. It's that we've got a whole global internet that we have to kind of, you know, fix in place whilst it's running. And that may be, you know, a long time coming. And DNSSEC is a perfect example of, you know, security control that would be wonderful to have, but actually rolling it out, you know, comprehensively enough to really matter is a real challenge.
Well, DNSSEC is like Linux on the desktop. It's always just about to happen, right? And I have a feeling that BGPSEC and there are a few standards, you know, and I have seen presentations on various approaches to fixing BGP, and it's always that sort of PKI approach that looks like it's not really going to get you that far and it's going to be a lot of work, but let's see what happens with it. Zerodium, wasn't it? Dropped info about an exploit for Tor browser on Twitter, which was pretty
funny. Yeah, it's good times. Zerodium, of course, buy zero-day on the market and then sell it to various people. They decided to drop one of their, you know, like surplus end-of-life bugs on Twitter as their form of disclosure, which, you know, is entertaining in itself. This particular one was interesting, I think, because
Well, it's interesting because it's an exploitation technique that you can describe in half of a tweet.
Well, yeah, there's definitely that bit. So the bug in question was essentially a NoScript bypass. So the browser that comes with Tor Browser Bundle, the Tor browser itself, ships with the NoScript plugin for Firefox that the Tor browser is based on. And this was basically a bypass of NoScript, which in itself is not going to get you super owned. I mean, it might, maybe you'll get, you know, enough JavaScript running to leak.
It might get you super decloaked, though.
It might get you super decloaked, but I think, you know, certainly if you are planning on owning people running Firefox, if you can get the scripting turned on, then you've got a whole bunch more attack servers, a bunch more bugs are going to work for you. So it's definitely one piece of the puzzle that you'd like to have in your exploiting Tor users pack. And so, yeah, this one got dropped. The guy who maintains NoScript fixed it fairly promptly, which is nice. The new version of Firefox, or the later version of Firefox that the newest Tor browsers are based on, they've changed a bunch of the plugin architectures.
So but you haven't told us the best bit, which is actually what the bug is.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, sorry. The actual bug. When you are returning a page to the browser and you would like to have scripts run, you set the content type to be text, HTML, semicolon JSON, and then it gets run.
Lovely.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine someone finding that one out, you know, discovering that one completely by accident, right? Like just seeing scripts render and then realize that someone set a funny content type and gone, oh, you know, you can sort of imagine that penny dropping.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But yeah, Zerodium obviously unapologetic about it. They said they bought it, they sold it to a bunch of their government clients. It's now useless. And so they just decided to drop it because, you know, I guess free publicity seems to be the main reason. So, you know.
Well, there you go.
Enjoy your free publicity, Chuki. Here you are.
And now you can get Tor browser on Android, apparently.
Yes, which, I mean, is good, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of people for whom Androids are their only, you know, choice of device, and having Tor available, you know, in a, you know, official form factor rather than, you know, 400,000 garbage, you know, Trojan ones that you're going to get from the app stores. You know, I guess that's an, this is an improvement, having a more official one, so that's good. Unfortunately, it is not on the official Google Play Store yet. I think there was the, it's still on some third party app store as well. So, you know, maybe you will get garbage ones. Mind you, I guess you get garbage ones in Google Play too.
And finally, Adam, the Government Accountability Office has released, in the United States, has actually released a report into the Equifax breach. So, you know, if you feel like reading a 40-page report about the Equifax breach, you now can.
Yeah, it is actually worth the read, despite being, you know, 40 pages long and a little bit dry. It does have a few, you know, kind of choice bits in it, I guess, in a way, because it comes down to the breach being really just, you know, super basic, workaday, boring IT stuff. Like, there's no glamorous, amazing, you know, things that they screwed up in here. They just, you know, they didn't
know they were running vulnerable struts in this one place, right? And people have been asking me, you know, because I did Snake Oilers last week. We, you know, I kind of hyped up the launch of Asset Note, a company that I'm getting involved with. And people are like, wow, I've never heard you shilling anything so hard. And it's like, well, you know, have a look at this report, you know, and maybe, you know, their customers are going to actually find their struts and not get owned. So that's kind of why I'm a booster.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly Equifax went round. They tried to find all their struts, they patched the ones they had, and then they missed some, and as a result, they got hella owned. And that is, you know, IT asset management's pretty basic stuff.
Well, it's almost like, I think that, you know, enterprises these days need to have, you know, they need to do their own recon. You know, they almost need to have attack-style recon on their own networks just to find what they need to fix, right? That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, because, I mean, it's really often not obvious what makes up all of the inner plumbing of, you know, of the bits of software you buy. Like, so much stuff ships with struts as a part of its, you know, admin interface that you don't see because it's actually a separate product you bought. You don't know that it's struts on the inside. So, yeah, having an attacker-centric approach to doing that kind of recon is super useful. The other thing I thought that was funny about the Equifax write-up was that they had systems in place to detect data being exfilled from their environment. And it was meant to be doing TLS intercept on the outbound, and they hadn't renewed whatever cert they were using, and it wasn't working. And they missed it for, you know, whatever it was, 2-3 months. As I said, just, you know, really workaday, basic bitch, you know, IT maintenance stuff.
Yeah.
And that's it's tragic and great and useful for many of our listeners in their day jobs to really kind of say, this is why we have to get the basics right.
Well, it has been long enough, right? And they say comedy is tragedy plus time. So pour yourself a cup of tea, read this report and get set for a chuckle. Adam, that is it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Pat. We'll talk to you then.
That was Insomnia security consultant and 90s dreamboat Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir, the big cheese at Thinkst Canary. Canaries, of course, are little hardware honeypots you can put on your network. You tell them to look like what you want them to, and if someone attacks them from inside your organization, well, then you know you've got a problem. One of the detection methods Canaries used to fire on was SNMP, if you'd configured them that way, but Thinkst has now removed that feature. Haroon joined me to discuss that decision and also talk about how a lot of security software out there simply has too many features. Here he is.
It's actually something we do pretty often. We just announced the last one on Twitter, and it ended up having some pretty good feedback. So what we've actually done in the last push, we've started deprecating SNMP as a thing that Canaries can be discovered with. It's ended up with a bunch of people actually being surprised and pleased at the step.
Now, why did you decide to axe the feature?
So SNMP is interesting. As pen testers, it's almost your feature of last resort. So if I can do absolutely nothing on this network, maybe I can find something with SNMP write strings, and I can put up Haroon was here on the sys.location of the device. So when we built Canaries, we looked for, here's the things that we would do if we were trying to footprint a network. Here's the things that we think give a high signal that there's an attack on the network, and SNMP was one of those things. It turns out that there's just so many networks that are badly configured with SNMP running around that you'd end up with customers deploying a Canary and then getting some device on their network doing printer discovery or looking for print management servers. And the customers would then go and they'd whitelist it because we allowed them to whitelist IPs or whitelist OIDs.
And let me guess, they'd spend a day a week whitelisting all of the crap on their networks, spraying SNMP everywhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like for some guys, it would just be a whitelist once or whitelist in the first few days that they got Canary. But over time, what's super clear is nobody ever caught anything with SNMP that didn't also trigger another service. So if there was an attacker who SNMP scanned you, he also touched your Canary somewhere else. And so for us, at the end of the day, it ends up adding more noise than signal. And it's one of those things that we've got a pretty strong mantra about making sure that we actually try to make the hard decisions. There's a few interesting things, but I think Moxie was famous for saying, and he took a lot of flack for it with Signal early on, where he went, we're not going to have 300 options and 300 dials like PGP has. We're going to make the best decisions we think for our users, and then most users will get that by default.
Emojis are for the decadent, basically, was his approach, right?
Yeah, but also, I think at the time he pointed out that the PGP man page was longer than Fahrenheit 451, because they went with every possible tweak and dial and then left this up to the users. And so in some cases, what we're doing is pretty much the same. Like, we know some users would choose this, but for most users, it just adds pain and friction. And in that case, we think we can do better. And so we've gone ahead and killed it.
Configurability is, to some degree, the enemy of good. I've always felt that. That's why I'm an iPhone user and not an Android user, right? But this extends to InfoSec as well.
Yeah, it's super interesting.
Our end goal should really be to make enterprise security products that are as minimally configurable as possible because they're effective in their default state, right?
Yeah, but you know the famous thing about I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one. Like that applies exactly to building software. Also, like if you have an option and you can't figure out whether the customer needs A or B, you go, let's give them both and let them decide. And the guys from 37 Signals always talk about this, and they talk about how much time is put into making the call and trying to get it absolutely right. Because the other way, most times, just becomes a lazy way to do things.
Yeah, I recently had an interview with Stefan Chenette. It was a sponsor interview. He runs Attack IQ, which does attack simulation stuff. And, you know, I asked him this question because he's sitting up on top of a pile of telemetry data from his customers. You know, their whole point is to, the whole point of their software is to measure the effectiveness of security controls by simulating attack traffic and then seeing, you know, if it's detected and how it's escalated through their, you know, through their rigs, right? And I'm like, well, where are the weak points? And he said, EDR. And I asked him, you know, is that because the software is no good? He said, no, the software is great. It's just no one configures it right.
Yeah, it's so that thing. And then you have like part of the reason that ends up happening, right, is like if you take us now removing SNMP, part of the reason other companies don't do this in a rush is because they end up competing on air quotes features. And so if you have an option to have two more checks in there, well, go for two more checks because now you can compete on having more things in there. And it's a weird kind of situation that we've ended up in.
Can it do this? People, yes, it can, but no one asks, should it?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody asks, should it? And then historically, you end up with other stuff, which is you open up your product's attack surface because now you're carrying around XML parsers and parsers in case somebody sometime wants to use the thing. And it ends up with what we normally talk about with software that sells well to VCs or sells well to people who aren't actually using it in the field. And we've been pretty lucky because we've kind of found, like in a way, we've found our audience. So the type of people who like our stuff are the sort of people who actually aren't buying on checklists, like they're buying based on it actually solving their problem. And so it gives us the flexibility to do more and more of this sort of stuff And yeah, so we've got a kind of a virtuous circle going where we can do the right thing and people actually like us for it. For me, a lot of making the right choices is interesting because it's so against what people typically expect when they're doing their development sprints. So for example, the fact that most security vendors don't adequately security test their code is kind of shocking. Like if you look at some of the complaints against the AV guys, who years and years into this still aren't running their code inside of sandboxes, like part of the reason they're not is just because they haven't been forced to do it. But in the end, you end up with this entire class of software that everybody is just waiting to dump. And yeah, it's an interesting problem. And I think you're starting to now see smaller companies push in the other direction, or at least newer companies push in the other direction and push towards software that's not junk by default.
I think there's another push as well, and you know, Greg Shipley was in of InQtel fame was in a feature interview a while back, and he said that as an industry, you know, particularly the security industry, we need to move beyond the idea that pumping an alert into a console means our job is done. Right?
Yeah, it was an interesting interview, and he was talking about, well, how do we get past this to the point where software actually starts solving the problems for you instead of just telling you that it solved the problem or making you aware of the problem. And we see a fair amount
of this.
It's funny,
if you want to use like a bit of a metaphor, you know, security software is basically someone on Twitter who just shit posts, right? Never provides any sort of ideas about what you might want to do to fix the problem. They just, you know, security software complains a lot is my point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's so I certainly hear the case, and I think there's actually a deeper problem with that. And one of the reasons why I think there's a deeper problem is almost in the fundamental way that software is built these days. So if you have an idea and you start a company and you build a product, and at some point you do the whole rapid scaling thing, you get in venture capital, you start building out features. Two things happen. One is you start building features for checklists. So can my product do this? Can my product do that? And then you've got faceless developer number 23 who's building in your JSON importer, your XML importer. And what you end up with is a whole bunch of people working on a product and working on features that almost never get used. And what you end up seeing is, like, it's a horrible meme to pull out. But you know when you get the, you had one job to do? You get lots of security products that, in the end, have one job to do and don't do that job. Because actually, they're spending hundreds and hundreds of development hours on all of these ancillary things on the side. So you end up with secure smartphones that can't accept an SMS without falling over. And at that point, you look at them and say, you had one job to do, accept this input and don't fall over.
It's funny. I'm going to go back to the mobile handset thing for a second. But, sure. You know, the reason I don't use Android is really, say I want to go to risky.biz and just pull up an old interview, right? I hit the MP3 thing. You know what Android does? It asks me 50 frickin' questions. What do you want to do with this file, guy? Do you want to download it, or do you want to listen to it? I'm like, I'd like to listen to it. Okay, what do you want to listen to it with? Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I don't need, man. You know, whereas if you know on an iPhone, you hit an MP3, it starts playing it, right? And if you want to go do some other stuff in another browser window or a tab, you can, and it'll keep playing it, right? So just those little things where sometimes, you know, taking some control away from the end user is actually not a bad thing, because the end user adapts to your better way of doing things, right? So there are some really dumb configuration options on security software that just shouldn't be there. It makes me wonder why they are there.
Yeah, it's often, and this is the thing.
Okay, so this is the thing. I don't wonder why they're there. I know why they're there. And most of the time it's because a key customer contacts the software company and says, we need this, right? They build the feature and then they go, hell, we'll just give it to everyone, right? And they need to stop doing it.
We might as well ship it.
Exactly. Yeah, stop shipping it to everyone.
Yeah, and part of the fundamentally, even if it's not stuff that a customer has asked for, the logic that says we'll throw the kitchen sink in it because more code is better code, you would think of everyone, the security industry should know this. like more than anyone else, the security industry should be knowing that that actually lines of code are almost like a debt. Like you're gonna have more bugs, you're gonna have more complication. It's stuff that you're gonna be carrying around with you for a longer time. And yeah, it's something that people need to figure out isn't working out in the long run.
Well, Haroon Mir, congratulations on actually exercising some SNMP-related code from your products. That must have felt very nice doing that push. And look, thanks a lot for joining us on the show to talk about that. It's been very interesting.
Always fun. Thanks.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary there. Big thanks to him for that. And a huge thanks to Thinkst Canary for sponsoring this week's show. I'm not sure if I'll be running a feature this week. I'm putting two pretty good ones in the pipeline that I think will be very interesting, though. Basically, I'm trying to do longer and better feature interviews less frequently, and instead of trying to, you know, squeeze them into every show. And of course, I will be publishing them separately from the main weekly show so that we can run the news segment in this sort of new expanded form. I hope you'll all adapt to that okay, because I know people have mixed feelings about change. But yeah, in the meantime, do check out last week's Snake Oilers podcast. I think it was pretty cool. And yeah, until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.